to be joined very, very shortly by Dr. Andrew Shepherd. We're going to be talking about the US-Israeli-Iran war. So if you don't want to hear about that, maybe tune back in after quarter past, maybe even after 20 past. I'm going to start talking about it now. We are into the 11th day of the Israel-US-Iran war. In those 11 days, the US and Israel have assassinated Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's ruler and Shia Islam's religious figurehead. Iran, meanwhile, has struck at least 10 countries in the Middle East, and the price of oil has jumped to $100 a barrel. Quite a lot has been happening in a very short amount of time. Meanwhile, the White House has promoted this conflict with strange, machismo-ridden promotional videos that splice video game clips and movie scenes with bombing footage. To discuss this strange war and this strange new world, we have Dr. Andrew Shepherd from Otago Whakaihu Waka. You're joining us from the Te Whanganui Ātara campus. Is that correct, Andrew?
Well, I'm joining you from a home office in Te Whanganui Ātara.
Oh, yeah. Oh, nice.
Good to mention that.
It's good to have you on the program, Andrew. I'm very, very happy that you made time this morning to talk about such a complex and depressing issue.
Yeah. I was struck by actually your comment about even your invitation to tune out there rather than tune in. You know, to your listeners, hey, if this is going to depress you, then you can tune out, come back in 15 minutes. And, you know, in many ways, this is the strange new world we live in, where we engage with sort of the political realities of our world in sort of ways that we can tune in and out, depending on whether it feels good to us at the moment. Now, obviously, partly we do that for mental health reasons.
Yeah.
But even that idea that we can, you know, we're in a privileged position to do that, obviously, is worth kind of pondering on.
I agree. I completely agree. It is a privilege to be able to tune out. But myself, I mean, I've had like my stress levels have been pretty high this week, thinking too much about this conflict. So I imagine other people are in a similar boat. Talking about this conflict, though, Trump has tried to brand himself over the past year or so as the peace president, despite kidnapping the leader of a sovereign nation in Venezuela, backing an ethno-state, Israel, which is committing genocide. He's mates with Putin, and now he's firing on Iran. I think there were 3,000 strikes in total. What does peace to Donald Trump mean? Is it domination? Is it control?
I actually think your key point there is the idea he's tried to brand himself as a peace president. You know, one of the things that we should have noticed by now with Trump, you talked about the strange new world. The reality is where we are now living in, say, a reality presidency. You know, this is a real estate tycoon who then ran a reality TV show called The Apprentice. He's used to shock, you know, because that's what keeps people attentive. And so, this is a branding exercise. So how do you keep people interested in the Trump presidency? How do you keep them distracted from other issues? Then you pivot towards talking about peace. So, you know, after the initial chaos of him turning up, and I was in the States last year for residency and watching things, thinking, oh, I wonder how long this sort of chaos will ensue, which for quite a while. And then obviously there's this almost this pivot to then begin to discuss this idea of, you know, being a peace president. And, of course, it doesn't take a lot to go, well, hang on, this has got nothing to do with peace presidency. It's just about a sort of form of image projection to the world. And the fact that then we've literally seen that then play out in, you know, in the space of less than 3 months from receiving the curiously peace awards from Nobel Peace Prize winners in Venezuela who then offer their baubles to Donald Trump. I think, I don't think he's not interested in peace at all. It's another bauble to his sort of constant desire for acclaim and adulation. I think most people psychologists would suggest there's a sort of a narcissistic sort of element to his personality.
Malignant narcissism is the term I've seen thrown around.
And obviously that's the thing. People who hang around narcissists for a long time, you know, they're very damaging consequences. And here you have a narcissist who has exceptional power and control. And, yeah, so the peace thing, there is nothing peaceful at him at all. And, I mean, I just, the whole thing is just a a projection. It's a vacuous term.
Let's start talking about the sort of holy war messaging that's been present in previous US wars that might not be present in this one. For instance, in the 80s, Reagan's support of the holy Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the godless Soviets in the 80s. George Bush, of course, said that God instructed him to invade Afghanistan and Iraq in the 2000s. We know that there are folks like Mike Huckabee in the Trump administration who think that Israel deserves the entire Middle East. That's a real quote. Are we seeing similar religious messaging from the US around this war?
Yes and no. I mean, the thing about the States is it's so seeped in sort of religion, and in particular Christianity, that, you know, any presidency always is using religious language, theological language. It just goes with the territory of being the US president. You can't become US president without speaking about, you know, the significance of your faith or of why you think you had some sort of religious mandate. I think you take that all with a pinch of salt. That just goes with the territory. Certainly in the past, you know, the US has had this sense in which they're, you know, providing some moral good for the world. Within this presidency, I think there are some within the presidency, particularly new Secretary of War, Peter Hegseth. I mean, he is an explicit Christian reconstructionist, so he has a Christian theological view that says the best thing to do would be to construct some sort of theocratic, a theocracy, Christian theocracy in the United States. Mike Huckabee would be the others. But I think it's a mistake to think that everybody within the administration holds to that view. I think there are certainly people who hold to that personally. But there are others who are just ideologically driven. And in many ways, I think what's going on in the administration is sort of a contestation and a bit of a sort of a fractured reality with, of course, then the leader whose policy shifts day to day, again, depending on what keeps him in the limelight or distracts from, you know, other important issues like, say, the Epstein issue. You know, some critics and commentators would say, oh, well, the planning to attack Iran seems to coincide with the rising clamour to release all the Epstein files. So I think the holy war messaging is there. It's not it's explicit. You know, it's not like 2003, 2004, where there was language around, you know, the axis of evil being overcome. In many ways, actually, what you're hearing, there's an element of that. But this time the conversation, the motivation for actually the bombing, actually, if you listen to different members of the administration, the reasons for doing it are like completely different. One was to stop nuclear weapon development, even though they've already bombed it and obliterated it, supposedly. One was because their hand was forced by Israel. One was to bring about regime change. So there doesn't seem to be actually a strong coherency about actually what the thinking is behind the war.
Yeah. The one piece of religious messaging that I've picked up on is from different members of the cabinet who have said that Iran is ruled by religious lunatics, which is kind of ironic.
Exactly, and herein lies exactly that's the point. You know one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. Here, one person's religious lunatic is another person's faithful adherent to a faith.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, and likewise in Iran, those exact conversations will be taking place as well, with being attacked by Christian religious lunatics.
Speaking of, there are some evangelical Christians in the US who are seeing this siege as the beginning of the end times, and we know that a few of them are in the Trump administration. A lot of them are Trump voters because they see him as the sort of person to herald the end times. How many of these types, you know, are there, and is their presence in politics worrisome, especially in the world's biggest superpower, for preventing the outbreak of war if they want to bring about an apocalypse so they can go to heaven?
I mean, this is, we could spend a long time talking about this. I mean, the word evangelical Christian is a long historical use.
Yeah.
For your listeners, probably it's worth recognizing that evangelical Christians in the United States were overwhelmingly Democratic voters right through to Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s. And therefore, strong on environmental themes, on justice issues. What takes place, I mean, this is a brushstroke reflection, but what takes place in the early 1980s is that President Reagan, when he runs for presidency and the moral majority, basically begin to court the evangelical Christians with the kind of the religious right, and begin to play up sort of what they would see as more moral issues, and moral issues being personal moral issues, so questions of sexuality, questions of abortion. Now, obviously, arguably, war, environmental treatment are fundamentally moral issues, but these moral, personal moral issues become sort of the primary way that evangelical Christians begin to sort of identify their politics, and they become sort of this marriage, which is now probably 30, 40 years between sort of the right, or the political right, the conservative right of the United States, which is the Republican Party, and evangelical Christian. But that's not always been the case. And also recognizing that even evangelical Christians themselves don't all, right, lots of them will vote right. But even there again, it's a broad stream. And so the tendency is to sort of create the sort of demonized other. So, the problem here is evangelical Christians. Yes, some of their views are deeply problematic, but recognize here that there's a broad perspective of sort of Christianity within the United States, not just evangelical Christian. And in terms of the question then about apocalypse, some of them would hold sort of some pretty extreme views. Again, if you look through Christian history, if you look through any religious history, there's always this tendency to adopt sort of these ways of viewing the world which makes sense of the world and our place in it, and adopting a sort of a simplistic, good versus evil, us versus them. We were on the side of good. Yeah, it's a pretty common tendency within human societies.
I appreciate that very nuanced answer. But you can see that some people would be concerned about, you know, someone who believes that the end times need to happen for their religion to go ahead, and that if they are, you know, if they've got their hand on the big red button, it is a bit scary.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I share those concerns passionately. So the nuance here, but I guess what I'm saying is the tendency from those outside a tradition, or from a position of non-faith, is to say, the problem here is evangelical Christians. But the reality is the problem here is not evangelical Christians. The problem is a White House and a sort of a political system where these people have started voting sort of demagogues into power.
Yep.
So my concern is more around, again, there's always a give and take here, the relationship between politics and between sort of faith perspective. The rise of sort of white Christian nationalism for somebody like me who comes from within the Christian tradition is not deeply troubling. It's abhorrent. I watch and I think, oh my goodness, this is like the rise of, we've seen this before in history, where a cultural expression of Christianity, and in particular white Christianity, takes hold, and often closely linked to then, anti-Semitism or the demonization of other, or Islamophobia.
Yeah, no, totally agree. It's politics is where things come out. You've suggested that this siege could be looked at from a Baudrillardian, big word there, perspective, where this conflict is not necessarily a war, but really a spectacle focusing to distract us, and we're fed it through our phones and our TVs. The term Baudrillardian sort of simulacrum when it comes to war was sort of coined in the 90s with the first Gulf War. If the recent White House's Twitter posts that splice video games and movie scenes with bombing footage are anything to go by, it seems like it's the case. What's the desired effect from turning war and violence into a display from the public, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really insightful question, particularly the idea of, exactly that video that was released is sort of a splicing of reality with, say, hyper reality. Jean Baudrillard is a French philosopher who came up with this idea. He provocatively said the Twin Towers never happened, which of course outraged people. But his point was here was that we now live, going back to your earlier comment, is that we live in a moment of sort of arguably hyper-reality. So we've lost an ability to distinguish between what is real and what is sort of a performed hyper-reality taking place in sort of some sort of simulated reality. And arguably, his argument is that this was about true of the sort of the previous Gulf Wars. And in one sense, we see that here now, it, you know, advanced even further. So you have not just the White House who then, in previous, you know, wars, you would have these briefings, but now what you actually have instead of a briefing is sort of this blurring of this sort of hyper, the world, the virtual world that we live in, the sort of simulated reality of video games and Hollywood, which is then spliced together with actually the real reality, which is bombs being rained down on Tehran. Mm. Again, the question in terms of what the desired effect, that assumes that there's some sort of puppet who is, you know, that this is just simply a utilitarian or a methodology being employed by some evil, malevolent sort of, you know, Bondian figures from a James Bond movie. But actually, we all live in that reality. Mm. That's the reality that we live in now. Mm. You know, this is like the movie Don't Look Up. You know, we live in a world where we know that we're facing, you know, runaway climate change. But like that movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, what we do is that we then immerse ourselves in distractions and simulations and other things going on, because actually that reality is just too overwhelming for us.
We can't confront it.
It's like The Matrix, if you remember the movie, the 1999 Matrix movie, where he's eating a steak and he's like, I know this isn't real, but, you know, but why would I want to go live in the real world when I could just be living on the simulated reality? And I think it's important to recognize that we all live in that world now. Mm. And so the question is, how do we somehow break ourselves free from these hyper realities that we live within, from an age of distraction where our attention, you know, our attention is pulled. At the moment, our attention is on the war in Iran. But last week it was, you know, and for a few months it was a war in Gaza. Mm. And before that, it was a war in Ukraine. Mm. So actually what takes place is that our attention is shifting from one thing to another thing to another thing. But if you actually just scratch the surface and say to someone, what's the histories on these? What's driving these? How can we possibly respond beyond the sort of the emotive response, which is, oh, this is terrible, this is shocking. We don't actually know a lot because our attention is constantly being shifted to other directions. That it strikes me that we live in an age where, you know, we're caught in this sort of infotainment. And so war has become like another infotainment that those of us in parts of the world, and this is true also of climate change, we can sort of stand and watch as a spectacle, and we can comment on it and put up social media posts on it and express our opinions on it. But actually, by and large, we're insulated from those realities.
Yeah. There was a really telling video of an influencer in Dubai who was filming Iran firing drones around Dubai, and she said, it's not supposed to happen here. It's not supposed to happen here. And that is a moment where her reality is pierced through with the situation that so many people have to live with, which is, war does happen. We don't experience it because we export it, or we fund it, or it's somewhere else. We never face it. But her, in that moment, this UK lady, she felt real reality.
And that, you know, and those realities have happened for us and maybe not for your listeners, who probably are a younger demographic, but, you know, 9/11, the bombing in London, and the bombings in Bali, those were those piercing realities which brought home to Western society, which is, this conflict, these acts of terrorism which happen on a daily basis in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Somalia and Haiti and other failed states, this is happening in our background, in our front garden, so to say. Those are the realities that wake us up from sort of the hyper reality that we live in to the actual realities of the now. Mm. What that means for us, well, I hope those things don't materialize again. But certainly, the war that's now being waged will not bring. You know, to bring back to the beginning of the conversation, it won't bring peace. All it will do is sow the seeds for further violence down the track. You know, it'll create more, you know, pockets within the Middle East who detest the great Satan who is raining weapons down on them. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm not overly positive, but I also don't want to then, I guess, you know, unlike your invitation to to listeners, while I recognize the importance of mental health, the encouragement to sort of tune out and tune back in later in actually exacerbates the issue of thinking that we can somehow pick and choose the world that we live in.
Mm.
And it strikes me that rather than living in a hyper reality, we're encouraged to live with the sheer difficulty of living in the moment of these realities, but also then say, well, what's my response here? And, you know, some of those responses might be asking, well, hang on, how does my way of being in the world fund either directly or indirectly these conflicts elsewhere? How can I here be involved in somehow assisting peace building in both my own context but elsewhere around the world?
Yeah, that's a really good note to leave this chat off. I really appreciate your time, Andrew. Have a great day.
Awesome. Thanks, Jack. Lovely to chat.
That's great.
Take care.
Take care. Bye. All right, folks, that was Andrew Shepherd from the University of Otago, based out of Te Whanganui Ātara. We're talking to Andrew about the war in Iran. We're going to play...
That was a Radio 191 event podcast! You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.